Hello and welcome to World Business Report here from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. An election theme to the programme. We're going to be talking about the Japanese elections in a few minutes' time. And later we'll look ahead to the US election. Could Pittsburgh's steel legacy shape the path to the White House?
It wasn't just foreign steel that pretty much took away the competitiveness of steel in Pittsburgh. It was steel elsewhere in the U.S. and other technologies that really we were pretty slow on investing in here in Pittsburgh, for sure.
But let us start in the world's fourth largest economy, which, of course, is Japan. Its Prime Minister, Shigeru Ishiba, has insisted he will not step down despite a historic loss by the governing coalition in Sunday's election. These people in Tokyo said politicians, including Mr. Ishiba, had been punished for losing touch with voters.
I think the outcome was the result of people across Japan wanting to change the current situation here. I believe a new leader can change Japan in a new way rather than requiring a new administration or a new party.
Even if he continues, I still hope that the corruption issue will be settled and that Japan's economy and security issues will be addressed properly.
Let's analyse some of those results now. Now, if you were listening to the programme on Friday, you would have heard Tobias Harris, founder and principal at Political Risk Advisory Japan Foresight, also with us Nobuko Kobayashi, partner with strategic consultants EY Parthenon in Tokyo. Tobias, I'm going to come to you firstly. You told us this may happen. It has happened. What does it mean for Japan now? Political instability, is that possibly going to lead to economic instability?
Well, in the near term, I think the political stability or instability will probably be relatively contained in that, you know, they're going to try to figure out a configuration that works going forward, try to at least stabilize how Japan is governed and how policy is made. Over the longer term, though, to the extent that there are problems that really require decisive action by the government, I think it's going to be difficult to expect that under the current situation.
Who is going to form the next government? Is it possible to say at the moment?
I think it is increasingly shaping up to look like it will be an LDP-led minority government. I think with Ishiba as prime minister, I think it's going to be very difficult for the LDP to remove him if he does not want to go, and it does not look like he wants to go. And frankly, I'm not sure anyone else in the LDP really wants to take over this situation, given that he really has a tough job ahead of him. So I think the most likely outcome at this point is going to be a minority government, because frankly, the most likely new members of a coalition have very quickly ruled out the possibility of joining a government, but have said that they would be external partners for the government and would work with the LDP on policies of mutual interest, but they don't want to give the LDP the support it needs at this time.
Stay with us, Tobias. I want to bring in Nobuko in here. We have been talking a lot on this program about the weakening of the yen. What sort of impact is this political result likely to have on it?
Right. The weakening of yen is due to the speculation that it may be hard for BOJ to keep the rate hikes the journey embarked on earlier this year. And the depreciation of yen as a result will be, in the short run anyway, positive for the stock market. So that's why we saw the Nikkei average jump about 2% yesterday.
We did see that jump, didn't we? I wonder this. It's an important week, isn't it? Big decisions to be taken by the Bank of Japan. Will this political instability affect those decisions in any way?
That's an open question, and BOJ should be independent of the political movements. But in reality, it could be influenced. Whether the Governor Ueda can maintain its independence and stay on course is yet to be seen, because now the LDP has to accommodate and align with the opposition party's policies more.
Tobias, coming back to you here, corruption clearly was a central issue in one of the big central issues in the way that people voted on Sunday. But can I talk to you about that cost of living situation? Japanese wages not going up quickly enough. How big a factor was that, do you think, in these elections?
I mean, I think we can talk about the corruption scandal as really the most proximate trigger for the outcome that we saw, and really for the erosion in support for the LDP that we've seen over the last year. But I do think the deeper frustration that you see in Japanese politics, and really this extends to the opposition. I mean, I think there's a real sense that the political system is not really working for people. I think there's a reason why turnout fell a couple points compared to even the last election, which is still historically below historical norms. And I think a big part of that is a feeling that during the ABBA years, you know, there was growth, you know, corporate profits were up. You saw all sorts of indicators that suggested that things were going well. But I think a lot of people did not feel that really at home and in terms of how their incomes were and how their situation was. And I think for a lot of people, they feel left behind. And that, I think, was the irony being that Ishibo was someone who I think understood that and tried to campaign on that, but obviously hasn't had time to do anything about it. And of course, I think what we've seen in the last couple of years with higher inflation and wages not really keeping pace, clearly that has really brought home the fact that a lot of people have been left behind. And when you add the corruption scandal to that, the sense that the LDP was sort of taking care of itself and doing whatever it wanted and was being, unethical at the very least, while people were being left behind, I think that frustration all added up together to the situation we have now.
Nabucco, your thoughts? Something that we were discussing on the program on Friday was Japan was a leader when it came to analog technology, not so good when it's come to digital technology. Whoever comes to power, do you think they're going to have to see Japan and help Japan push forward in the AI era that we're moving into?
Yes, AI is one of the areas recognized as a growth area and certainly the focus of investment for Japan. So the growth strategy, which never really was fully implemented under Abenomics, I think it's a leftover homework from the Abenomics era. And whoever takes the helm has to focus because there's a limited fund and invest in the key areas, including AI, to push Japanese economy forward.
Nabucco, thanks for joining us. Tobias, final thoughts from you. Abenomics, we talk about it a lot, that sort of economic policies that were associated with one of Japan's most famous prime ministers. Is this a sign that they have now moved away from those policies?
I think those policies are really sticky. I think we're finding. I think, you know, exiting radical extreme monetary easing, I think, has proved difficult. I mean, not impossible, but difficult. I think reorienting Japan back towards fiscal discipline is receding into the distance again with the political issues that we're seeing now. This question about the growth strategy, yes, they're going to keep doing that. And they're going to keep trying different things with industrial policy. And so that just now seems baked in. So, I mean, Abenomics is very sticky. I think it's very hard for any political leader to, you know, they can say that they oppose it or they want to try something different. It's really hard to extricate Japan from that set of policies. I mean, it really is still the order of the day in a number of important ways.
Tobias, as always, thanks so much for joining us. Let's quickly bring in Peter Jankowskis, Vice President, Research and Analysis, Arbor Financial Services in Chicago. And Japan deals with a different problem to many other economies. We talk to you a lot, Peter, don't we, about inflation, the need for the rate at which prices increase to come down. Japan wants them to go up.
Indeed, yes. They've been suffering from deflation for, it seems like, more than a decade now. Fundamentally, they have issues with growth or lack thereof. They have issues with their aging population, excess savings, totally different from most any other economy in the world, as you've said.
Peter, stay with us. We're going to go to see one of the world's other big economies, Germany, actually, which overtook Japan recently. Volkswagen plans to close 3 plants, lay off thousands of workers and cut pay by 10%. That's according to trade unions in Germany. VW wouldn't respond directly to the claims, but said the situation is serious and that the company was at a decisive point in its corporate history. Here are what some Volkswagen workers had to say.
The cuts are very drastic, and that naturally causes anxiety. You have to look at how you can feed your family.
This naturally unsettles a great many people, because it fundamentally calls into question the future and how things will continue here.
Earlier, I spoke to Jens Sudekump, professor of economics at Düsseldorf University, who's also on the advisory body for the Federal Ministry of Economic Affairs.
The problems that we see at Volkswagen today, many people will identify them with the broader problems of the German economy.
What are those wider problems? Because here you have a company that has been one of the major players in the global car market, and now it seems to be losing that position. Is that a reflection of German manufacturing to some extent?
Absolutely so. I mean, if you look at growth figures, Germany is the only major economy in the world that is basically stuck in a recession. We haven't had growth for the last 4 or 5 years. We're really falling behind. And in hindsight, it's really like we didn't use the good years that the German economy had. So the decade between the financial crisis and the pandemic, where times were really good, where interest rates were low, we could have used that time for major investment in new business models. So that didn't happen. The infrastructure is really in a pity state. So the German economy is facing big structural problems. And you can pretty much say the same things about Volkswagen. The crisis that we see today unfolding is the result of problems that were built up over a longer term. Sales for Volkswagen were fantastic, but they didn't really use that golden decade to think about what's coming next, what's their business model for the future. We're at a time where the business model of Volkswagen is really, really in big danger.
Is that, to be fair to Volkswagen, some of it not out of their hands?
Problem is that Volkswagen, or pretty much all German automakers, they don't really have good products when it comes to electric vehicles. They are just too expensive for the quality that they have, and they're not competitive with the Chinese brands. And Volkswagen is losing big time. They're losing market shares in the Chinese market. That's their biggest problem. The second problem is that the domestic market is not really compensating anything, because sales of electric vehicles are not taking off as expected. All of that comes together and forms a toxic mix for Volkswagen and for the German auto industry in general.
These three plants that look like they're going to close, that's the first time the company has ever closed plants in Germany. But from the picture that you're painting, may they have to close more in the future?
So basically, if Volkswagen does not manage to come up with affordable electric vehicles that are competitive in their quality, competitive in their price, within, say, the next 3 to 5 years, then I think this company is just going to disappear.
That is quite a statement to make. Do you think that they will be able to do that? We're talking more about new technology here, new softwares. Can you see them being able to compete with the Chinese and other manufacturers like the Koreans?
I think if they really devote full energy to that project, I still have quite some hopes. It's not that they didn't do anything over the last 10, 15 years. They just didn't do it at the required speed and with the required energy. And they were still kind of mingling in between electric vehicles and the combustion engine, their investment decisions. They were not fully determined. So, but I think if now basically they take the crisis to make a serious restructuring of their production decisions, and they really put their energy on that project to basically become competitive in the market for electric vehicles, still see a future for them, but not if we are basically carrying on. So a little bit of electric vehicles, a little bit of combustion engine, I think that cannot work.
What sort of reaction is there to Volkswagen shutting down factories in Germany for the first time?
For many, it's just like a moment of shock, because it's something that was kind of expected, but it was never really spelled out clearly. And today, that news hit many people as a shock. Basically, it's not the only bad news that we're hearing in the German economy. It's just one out of many bad news. And that also is dragging down consumer confidence, the economy, the business cycle in general. This bad news is just feeding on itself. At the moment, the German economy is in a pretty dismal state.
Peter Jankowski is still with us. Interesting what Jens said there, because it's a challenge for many, many car companies, that threat from the Chinese EV makers.
Indeed. Having to restructure their existing industries, that's always very hard. For a newer entrant into the field, as China is, it's easier to step right into that new technology and move forward with it. So it is a very challenging time for automakers around the world. Daimler's, or I should say VW's, problems are certainly exacerbated by the high cost of energy in their area, as well as the relatively high cost of labor.
Certainly, it's a problem many car companies are facing. VW shares down 1% today. We're going to get the results of another great old car company, Ford. Be interesting to see how they are doing as well. You can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note, +44 330 678 3033. We talk a lot about electric vehicles. Tell us your thoughts on that. Have you got one? Are you thinking of buying one? Are they too expensive for you? We'd love to hear what you have to say. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. We started the programme, didn't we, talking about the elections in Japan. Let's move on to the elections in the US. They will happen a week on Tuesday, all this week here on World Business Report and later on Business Matters, we're going to be looking at the so-called swing states, the crucial states that will probably decide the election. Let's start in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, where we're going to focus now on the once important empire of global steel production. Our reporter, Monica Miller, has been there to look at the situation.
It's a rainy Sunday afternoon at City Works Eatery and Poorhouse in downtown Pittsburgh. Sports fans of the home team are watching an away game against the Indiana Colts. John Myhook sips his beer at halftime.
So are you from Pittsburgh?
I'm originally from Pittsburgh, but I live outside of Washington, D.C. now.
He's wearing a black and yellow Steelers jersey. The team was named after the industry that once put Pittsburgh on the map as an industrial powerhouse. He grew up at the same time the steel industry and towns across the region started to shut down in the 1980s.
So my generation, we all pretty much moved out of the Pittsburgh area.
Steeler Nation is everywhere.
That's Charles McAllister, a retired professor of industrial and labor relations from Indiana University of Pennsylvania.
We approximated 200,000 jobs, well-paying union jobs between Youngstown and Johnstown. That's why you've got seven steeler bars in Montana, is because everywhere around the country there are steeler fans and there it's the industrial refugees.
In the early 20th century, Pittsburgh and the towns in the Mon Valley produced the majority of steel in the market. U.S. Steel Corporation made the metal used to build America's railroads and ships during the Second World War. It was founded by Scotland native Andrew Carnegie and was once the most valuable company in the world, worth roughly $1 billion. But by the 1970s and 80s, the industry collapsed.
People don't like to think about it this way, but the steel industry in Pittsburgh really probably was at its peak not just 50 years ago, but 100 years ago.
I met Chris Bream at a coffee shop in downtown. He's a regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh. Chris says there were missed opportunities that made it hard to compete against cheaper products from Japan and Europe that flooded the market.
And even competition within the U.S., it wasn't just foreign steel that pretty much took away the competitiveness of steel in Pittsburgh. It was steel elsewhere in the U.S., the emergence of electric arc mini mills and other technologies that really we were pretty slow on adapt or investing in here in Pittsburgh for sure.
Fast forward to 2024. China is now the world's biggest producer of steel, and the U.S. is fourth in line. U.S. Steel Corporation ranks 24th internationally. But late last year, Japan's Nippon Steel offered over $14 billion to purchase the American iconic company. But it's facing political opposition ahead of the election.
U.S. Steel should remain American-owned and American-operated.
We are also going to keep U.S. steel right here in America.
Usually, U.S. presidents don't get involved with business acquisitions, but they do have the authority to block them through the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, known as CFIUS. There's concern that the deal could pose a threat to the steel supply chain needed for critical infrastructure projects. But the committee has decided the decision won't be taken up until the end of the year, after the election. But leaders from the Mon Valley, like the town of Braddock, say they need this to happen. Councilwoman Sharday Jones was surprised when Nippon Steel officials invited them to see one of their other plants in West Virginia.
I argue for them because we've also seen them, what they've done in West Virginia, to the point where they've become a part of the fabric of that community, to the point where they're building baseball fields. They actually said they were going to do something, and they did it. They showed a track record. People don't leave the Nippon, West Virginia, until they retire. And there's some young people that work there, and they're like, I've never thought I would get into steel, but here I am.
Braddock is less than a square mile, and today has a little over 1,700 residents. That's a 90% drop from its peak of almost 21,000 people in 1920. Nippon Steel promises the deal will have a $1 billion impact on the region's economy, create nearly 5,000 construction jobs, and generate $38 million in tax revenue. Professor Charles McAllister says if Nippon Steel follows through on their promises, they can build a new world on the ashes of the old.
We need to make things in this country, and we better grab it while there's still a connective tissue to that older knowledge base that once was the envy of the world.
Peter, still with us. Interesting to hear Monica's report there, because it is these states, isn't it, the likes of Pennsylvania, which will decide the election. One of the key things that we're seeing, one of the key trends we're seeing, is those non-college voters, highly unionized, shifting from the Democrats to the Republicans.
Yes, that has been a major shift, and certainly on the gender side of things, too, largely. Males becoming even stronger supporters of the GOP. And I think some of it is that in large part they feel that they've been left behind. Unions traditionally have been very strong backers of the Democratic Party, and their policies really haven't done much to help unions. They've certainly tried under the Biden administration to be more assertive and helpful to unions, but it appears that many people have had enough.
Yeah. Elon Musk, we do talk about him a lot on the program. Back in the news once again, the district attorney for the U.S. city of Philadelphia has filed a lawsuit against the political action committee controlled by the tech billionaire, giving $1 million cash giveaway to registered voters. Have you ever seen a somebody so successful in the world of business getting so involved in politics, Peter?
They tend to be more quiet and behind the scenes. And it's also very interesting in Mr. Musk's case with, you know, how much he's aggressively, you know, just jumped in here in the last couple of years to move to the Republican camp as well. In some respects, some of the articles talk about him feeling a little bit scorned when the Biden administration came in, was expecting to be more involved with some of the decisions involving EVs and was left out. And some of this is maybe a reaction to that.
Okay. Quickly, if you don't mind, Peter, it's a huge week, isn't it, in terms of those earning results? All the big tech companies, we had Tesla last week, but the others all reporting this week. What is the market expecting?
Well, I think they're expecting some continued very strong growth. I think it may be particularly challenging for Alphabet as well as Meta, those two firms, to see if they can support their both revenue and profit growth. Apple also is one that, you know, could potentially be in for a negative surprise as well.
Let us see what happens. Now, the world's biggest football team, it pains me to say that, but it is true. Manchester United has sacked its manager, Erik ten Hag. The club, which is worth more than $6 billion, parted way with him. He's been in charge since 2022. So when you've given someone a new contract, how do you come to that decision so soon afterwards? I've been speaking to Trevor Watkins, former chairman of AFC Bournemouth, another Premier League team. He's now global head of sport and entertainment at the law firm Pinson Masons.
I think it's always a difficult decision, and only if you're right within the club will you know what it is that has driven the decision to do this week. I mean, ultimately, the club's made a huge amount of changes in its staff over the last year, and this all leads to an impact on where the club is going, what the team is doing, and who's going to lead it in terms of coaching.
You have made those decisions. How do you know when it is the right time?
A lot of it is down to instinct. I'm sure that this has been on the mind of Manchester United executives for some considerable time. What's different from when I was chairman of a football club? If we wanted to buy a player or sell a player, that was pretty much a discussion between me and the manager. Of course, with the board and maybe the assistant manager, but ultimately that was it. Now, if you look at United, you've got the owner, you've got Dave Brailsford as a external third party influencing. We've also got a head of recruitment, a sporting director, a technical director, all the coaching staff. It's a much more complex operation, which makes it more complicated in when you make the decision ultimately is whether to replace the head coach, because you still have a huge organization in place that has been involved in making decisions to date.
I'm interested on instinct because it's such a difficult thing to quantify, but you might have an instinct that, ooh, this could be the right time. How do you go from that instinct to making the decision?
I think ultimately, if you look and you can see and feel that there really is no way back, you can't actually see a way of things being righted, or at least not in the short term, that then leads to a change. And most of the other positions have been changed at United. As I said, they've assembled a really star array of names from other clubs with lots of experience across football. And so this is probably the one change they could make, which is obviously the head coach. But ultimately, their future success is going to be about blending the management team into a really powerhouse, efficient, cohesive group that can drive the club forward to rekindle the success that it's had in the past.
You've been in this situation. How do you tell someone, that's it, goodbye? It's not easy, is it?
No, with great difficulty, because no matter who that person is, you've built relationships. The head coach will no doubt have great relationships with many of the players, if not all, and with the other staff. And everybody is human. And ultimately, at the end of the day, no matter what the compensation is, no matter how high that might seem, ultimately, someone loses their job. And that causes upset, that causes disruption. It means the club has to pave a new way forward. And for the manager, ultimately, to determine what he does next in his career. It isn't easy. And I wouldn't imagine it's anything anybody would like to do.
Peter, interesting to hear from Trevor Watkins there. In US sport, do people get a bit longer, or do they coaches get fired pretty quickly as well?
It varies quite a bit depending on the sport, but in general, it is easier to fire the coach than to fire the players. So quite often, if you don't see success in a few years, you're out the door.
Peter, you're out of the door for this program, but don't worry, we will bring you back again next Monday. As always, thank you for guiding us through those business stories there. We'll be back with Business Matters in a couple of hours' time. We're going to be focusing a lot more on Pennsylvania, the way that that working vote seems to be shifting and what it could mean for Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. But that's it for World Business Report.